Take some steel wire, bend it into a hook, and stick it on the end of a fishing pole. You know what you catch? The global economy is what you catch. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 25th of April. Glad as always to have you along, everybody. You know, trade has largely faded from the general economic news diet the past couple of weeks or so, on the hopes that maybe the whole tariff thing is going to blow over. First of all, it won't. Second of all, companies and industries affected aren't just sitting around. You know, Apple CEO Tim Cook, maybe the American CEO most vested in China economically, was at the White House today for a meeting with the president on this. Also, we have been doing some digging here at Marketplace into the hundreds of tariff exemption requests that the Department of Commerce has gotten from other not quite as ginormous as Apple American companies. 2,200 or so requests have been filed to get out from under the steel and aluminum tariffs, Commerce says. Remember, it's 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum. 300 or so exemption requests have been posted so far at regulations.gov, where they're up for 30 days so the public can make comments. Let me tell you dig through it and it is everything. A lot of big manufacturers in the steel industry are asking for millions of kilograms. That's how it's measured, kilograms worth of exemptions. But everyday household American-made products are on the line as well. Piano strings made by a 100-year-old American manufacturer. Schick razors, whiteboards, the ones you see everywhere. Also, this, Amanda Kimball's an engineer at Wright McGill Company in Colorado. They make fish hooks.
If we can't get the exemption, we will probably stop making that product altogether.
Their stainless steel hooks, she says, take about 5 tons of imported Japanese steel every year to produce. If White McGill can't get it, what will its customers do, do you suppose?
They would buy the ones that are built in China.
Arrow Gear in Downers Grove, Illinois, makes precision gears for aerospace companies, and they are facing tariffs on a specific grade of metal that they import from Europe. John Waller is a materials planner at Arrow. He says comparable American steel probably just isn't going to cut it.
There would be concerns about durability and life expectancy of the steel itself. You know, case in point, we wouldn't want to have a metal fatigue thing like recently with Southwest Airlines.
They are a bit down the supply chain from the consumer, Waller says, but higher tariff-induced costs, if the company doesn't get the exemption, could find their way into everyday plane ticket prices.
We're like a third-tier supplier, so we're sending to one company. They're adding it into the engine. The engine then gets sold to Boeing, and if my price goes up and then that guy's price goes up and so on and so forth, I'm not quite sure Boeing's in the market nowadays to just absorb those type of costs.
Regulations.gov are where these exemption requests are listed. You can check them out for yourself. They stay up for 30 days. All right, moving on. If what's past is prologue, we are in for a change of mood at the White House. French President Emmanuel Macron is on his way out of town after what you can only call a very warm reception from President Trump. German Chancellor Angela Merkel shows up on Friday. Thing is, the two European leaders are pushing basically the same agenda, economic and otherwise, but they are going to be greeted much, much differently, as Marketplace's Jed Kim reports.
So what's at stake for this meeting between the world's most powerful man and Europe's most powerful woman?
If Merkel can leave without a crisis in the relationship, she'll probably chalk it up as a success.
Jeffrey Anderson directs the BMW Center for German and European Studies at Georgetown. He says both sides have a lot to work out on Iran, Russia, China, and trade. Everyone doesn't have to be happy at the outcome, just not really angry.
That will leave at least space for the working level people at both state and Pentagon, but also in Europe, to try to make these issues work in the next couple weeks.
Both the Iran deal and a tariff waiver for the EU are set to expire soon. When it comes to trade, Merkel is bringing an entourage of CEOs from German companies, including Siemens and BMW. Trump has threatened tariffs on German cars. Dan Hamilton is with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins. He says Merkel will be laying out details of Germany's multiple investments in the U.S., which account for tens of thousands of jobs.
BMW has built a factory in Spartanburg, South Carolina, that's bigger than its factory in Munich.
And trade actions could threaten those jobs. Emma Ashford at the Cato Institute says Trump is fixated on the trade deficit the U.S. has with Germany.
Merkel may be trying to send this message that, you know, the U.S. benefits as much from this as we do. I doubt Donald Trump will see it that way.
Some American CEOs and lawmakers, including Republicans, are pressuring him to view things differently. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in global capitalism on Wall Street today, a little bumpy but calm by the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I know this is going to make it three, actually maybe it's 4 days in a row now that I've mentioned Mick Mulvaney, the acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or as he likes to call it, and as we told you yesterday, now officially the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection. But the guy does keep making news. Last night, in a speech to the American Bankers Association, Mulvaney said he wants to take a database that the CFPB keeps, or the PCFB, I guess it would be called. I don't know. Anyway, he wants to take that database, which is a record of complaints for consumers about banks and debt collectors and credit providers and others. He wants to take it offline and out of public view. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what is going on here and what it might mean for actual consumer financial protection.
If you have a problem with a debt collector or a bank, you can file a complaint with the CFPB. You can search these complaints online and see what problems other people have had with that company. Here's a complaint that shows up when you search for Wells Fargo.
Wells Fargo opened a fake account that I did not authorize, and then 1 month later, charged a fee for not having funds in it.
Now, from the perspective of a bank, this is pretty bad. You don't want people to be complaining for the world to see. What if these complaints are made up or false? The American Bankers Association told me it's fine with complaining, but opposes the public disclosure of unverified complaints. Debbie Goldstein is with the Center for Responsible Lending. She doesn't sympathize with the banks on this one.
First of all, there's a process that allows businesses to publicly dispute the claim.
Second of all, a funny thing happens when financial outfits have to worry about public customer complaints.
They start improving response time and responding more favorably to customer complaints.
Alex Howard is with the Sunlight Foundation, one of many groups that uses the complaints to study things like where are there problem spots in the financial industry.
What are people trying to hide?
Ann Bedour chairs the CFPB's Consumer Advisory Board and takes a very different view than the acting director.
The only financial businesses that would benefit from making this secret are the bad actors and businesses engaging in harmful market practices.
Last month, the CFPB opened a 3-month comment period for the public to offer views on how the agency deals with customer complaints, a sign a change is being considered. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This being a Wednesday, we're going to do another corner office interview, this one to be filed under, oh yeah, somebody's got to be running that company too, I guess. Jay Monahan is the commissioner of the PGA Tour, has been since the beginning of last year. And since it is finally golfing weather in many parts of this country, this seemed like a good time to get him on. Jay, it's good to talk to you.
Guy, thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
A little bit of nomenclature here, right? You run the PGA Tour, which is not the PGA, the Professional Golfers Association.
Correct. We were actually one and the same organization up until 1968 and then separated. But we are two separate organizations, but we work very closely together.
You've followed a guy, Tim Fincham, who had this job for, I think it's 22 years, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And you've been on the job for a couple of years. What's it like trying to take over an organization that's been run by one guy for 22 years, which is tradition-bound in a lot of ways, and yet now you find yourself in a news, media, and sports environment that is changing almost faster than you can turn around?
Well, I think it's, I guess to the first part of your question, Tim did an incredible job leading the PGA Tour for the 22 years. He was the leader, and I had the last 2.5 years of his tenure, I worked closely alongside him as deputy commissioner. You know, during that time frame, you're seeing, you know, a massive amount of change and disruption in the media and technology landscape, and that obviously affects what we're doing. 5 years ago, when you came to a PGA Tour tournament, we didn't allow you to bring your cell phone on site, and we've tried to eliminate a lot of those friction points to take advantage of the social currency that you see from our fans week in and week out. And we've also innovated around formats and schedule. We have big events March through July, and then the FedEx Cup playoffs will move to August and will precede the end of college football and the NFL.
What do you do, though? I mean, for all the Twitter live streaming you're doing and all the calendar rejiggering you're doing, what do you do about fans like me? I mean, I'm not a player, right? I'm a casual golf fan. It's not ever going to happen. I played a couple of par threes, and I'm just not good. But anyway, so I like to watch on television, but only under one condition. Well, two, actually. Mm-hmm. One is sort of Sunday of a big tournament, and really only if, like, Rory McIlroy or Tiger or, like, maybe Phil Mickelson is in, like, the final two pairings, you know? What do mm-hmm. you do about people like me?
One of the things that we're seeing over the last several years is there's such depth to our membership. You look right now, and there are, you know, you could argue there are 30 to 35 big names. It's creating a lot of what we call competitive friction. So when I go to bed, you go to bed on Saturday night, there's a decent chance a player that you are attached to or that you followed is going to have an opportunity to win. And so and really it's making certain that we are telling that story to as broad an audience as possible so that when that opportunity presents itself, you're aggregating the largest audience that you possibly can. And obviously the reemergence of Tiger, Phil's win in Mexico City, and obviously Sergio.
Well, right. Well, except for Sergio, you know, cratering at the Masters, but that, I guess that's a whole different deal, right?
It's a hard game. It can get you at any given point in time.
Spitball it for me, though. If you have this job for 20 years, 22 years, like Tim Fincham did, what does the PGA Tour look like when you step down?
I think you're going to see great growth internationally. And I just think in a day and an age and a world where it seems at times that things are getting less and less personal, a sport that is so multi-generational, I think it's in a great position to compete for mind share, to compete from a participation standpoint. And I just think you're going to see it continue to grow.
Well, let me ask you about that, though, because it sounds like you like things the way they are. And yes, you know, sure, CEOs have to say that their enterprise needs to grow. But where's the growth for you?
The growth for the PGA Tour is, you know, you look at our business model, primary revenue streams are sponsorship, and we're continuing to make certain that we are creating the right value equation for them. And I think longer term, there are opportunities to develop more direct relationships with consumers. We've had great success with PGA Tour superstores and our partnership with Arthur Blank. You're going to see us continue to bring our brand forward in ways that directly reach consumer and we think can help grow the game.
Jay Monahan, CEO, actually the commissioner, right, of the PGA Tour. Jay, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
As usual, we've got more of this Corner Office interview on our Corner Office podcast. Jay Monahan on the business model of the PGA Tour. You can subscribe wherever you choose to get your podcasts. Coming up.
20% tariff or 30% tariff. That could make everything we do unprofitable.
Imports and exports at one of China's biggest trade shows. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials was up 59 points today, about 0.25%, closed to 24,083. NASDAQ down, though, 3 points, less than 0.1%, 7,003. The S&P 500 up 4 points, about 0.1%, 26,39. In anticipation of that meeting we mentioned between German Chancellor Angela Merkel and President Trump, we check on a few German companies today. Industrial conglomerate Siemens sputtered 1.3%. Software company SAP scrolled down 1.1%. The pharmaceutical and chemical giant Bayer, or Bayer, depending on how you want to pronounce that, was off 0.5%. The DAX, Germany's main market index, dropped about 1% today. Twitter is joining the list of companies that beat analyst expectations this week with a strong quarterly earnings report that still did not somehow impress investors. The company posted a profit for the second quarter in a row, but warned that revenue growth may taper off. Capitalism being what it is, Twitter slipped 2.3% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The housing crisis in some of the biggest cities in this country, L.A. and New York, Chicago, Atlanta, lots of places, The housing crisis is pretty familiar. Not enough of it that is affordable. Here is another place, though, where you might not expect to find a housing squeeze. Midland, Texas, deep in the heart of the Permian Basin, the second biggest oil field on this planet, which is amazing, and where production has tripled over the past 5 years. Lots of jobs have opened up to make that happen, of course, but all those people got to live someplace, right? With the second part of our series from the cities of the Permian Basin, Midland and Odessa, Texas, Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on the housing economy in a boomtown.
If you head west on I-20 from the Midland Airport, you'll see a lot of 18-wheelers, a lot of pickup trucks. And on the horizon, the oil derricks and pump jacks, just like you see in the movies. About half an hour down, right on the service road, is what looks like a high-end RV park, with mobile housing units lined up one after the other. It's called Iron Horse Ranch Lodge, and it's what local people refer to as a man camp. Big oil companies like Halliburton and ExxonMobil get their employees' rooms here. Most firms foot the bill while the employee's working in the oil patch. Mike Milner's one of the workers staying here. He just started with a new company, and he's on a 10 days on, 5 days off schedule.
I live in Houston. My old lady's in Houston. My two kids are in Houston, so I'm gone 10 days gone, 5 days home. It's tough because my kids are small and they want to see me. My daughter will be 4 next month. My boy just turned 5.
If he drives home to Houston, it takes 8.5 hours. Milner says the man camp feels like a college dorm room, but for now, it's the best option he's got.
The housing market out here sucks. Apartments are, 3 to 5 month waiting lists.
He wants to drive his family's RV down here so his wife and kids can stay in it when he's on the rig, but
They're price gouging the hell out of RV spots out here. I've never had to pay $700, $800 for an RV spot, but that's what they're charging.
At least when Milner's not on the job, he can return home to Houston. Other workers come to town from all around the country and house up in the man camps even when they're not working. Jim Stevens came from Pennsylvania because he couldn't get a job working on an oil rig up there. He says the labor market here is so tight, entry-level gigs can pay $60,000 a year, even with no experience. He says his company's housing him in a man camp, too.
They provide your own room, which is nice, other than the other guys sharing, like, 4 dudes in a room. But you have to pay $30 a day. You have 30 days of that, and then you're kicked out of the man camp.
Steven says he's thinking about staying in an Airbnb after his 30 days or looking for an apartment or a rental house, but he knows that's a long shot because even if he can afford to pay more than he wants, there's just no supply. Longtime Midland resident Dustin Freeman struck lucky. Years ago, with savings from his restaurant job, he bought a 3,000-square-foot home. His realtor friend told him he could rent it out right now for $4,500 a month.
Crazy expensive. I mean, one-bedroom apartment for $1,400 a month, that's like New York City prices. But they could charge it because they knew they could get it, which, it's supply and demand.
He says whenever oil prices spike and production ramps up, developers rush to build. Apartments, condos, even hotels. But building in a boom carries its own risk. Freeman remembers when oil was $100 a barrel back in early 2014.
I think we had 2 or 3 apartment buildings that were in process that just didn't get finished for a while because then everybody was gone. There was nobody to live in them.
With oil prices now nudging $70 a barrel, developers in the Permian are trying to build homes and housing units as fast as they can. Myra McKinley's a listing agent here with Keller Williams. She says it's a great time for people in her business, except that you have to disappoint so many people.
The builders are opening up new phases in some of the subdivisions, so there's a lot more building permits that are going out, but there's no way to catch up.
She and her colleague, Lauren Lambden, are showing a house to a couple in Midland's Museum District.
I like the floors.
Yeah, the floors are great.
Lambden says this couple likes the house, but they're offering more than the listing price, so they'll have to wait and see if the bank's willing to lend them the money. She's anxious to seal the deal soon because
the moment that a move-in ready house goes on the market, it's gone.
The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics says Midland has the 5th lowest unemployment rate in the nation. People here often say that if you want a job and you're capable of doing the work, you can get one. Putting a roof over your head, that's something else altogether. In Midland, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is going to Beijing next week for trade talks. Mnuchin said he is optimistic that a trade war can be avoided, which would be, to be clear, a good thing. But a whole lot of people whose livelihoods depend on the global import-export business are a little bit uneasy. Over the next couple of weeks, something like 200,000 buyers and sellers of globally traded products are gathering at the Canton Fair. It's one of the world's biggest trade fairs. Jennifer Pak, our China correspondent, went to the southern Chinese city of Guangzhou to see how they're feeling.
At the Canton Fair, thousands of companies set up booths eager to show off their latest products, from power tools and chemicals to speakers like this one.
Do you want it?
The exhibition covers some 12 million square feet. Picture 68 Walmart supercenters put together. It's an impressive display of China's manufacturing power. Brad Schultz from Scottsdale, Arizona, is visiting the Canton Fair for the first time. He's seen a couple of items he wants to sell on Amazon this Christmas, but he's nervous about placing an order.
You know, if we have a shipment on the way, or like I said, we've already prearranged with our labels and get hit with a 20% tariff or a 30% tariff, that could make everything we do unprofitable.
So how are producers dealing with this uncertainty? This Android TV made by Skyworth is one of the items that will face a potential 25% U.S. tariff.
Our plan is to see whether we can open our own factory in the U.S. or cooperate with an existing factory.
A manager at Skyworth, Mr. Liu, he doesn't want us to reveal his full name for fear of retaliation by the government in China. Trade is a sensitive topic right now. The U.S. argues that TV manufacturers like Skyworth are benefiting from China's industrial policies, which give them an unfair advantage over American firms. Sellers here say they should get government help, since China is still developing. The Android TV, for example, is made in China, but the software is not. Again, Mr. Liu.
The TV sets we export to the U.S. have content made in America, such as the Google Play Store, YouTube, Netflix.
And he says other countries they sell Android TVs to also download American apps, not Chinese ones. But there's plenty of innovation here in China. A crowd gathers around a machine that prints designs on fingernails. Alex Zhang is with the company that makes it, iNail, and he says he sympathizes with American firms and acknowledges that Chinese competitors have copied their products. His advice to the Americans?
Invest more time and money in research and development to stay in the lead. Then it will be hard for others to surpass you.
Many manufacturers say they feel squeezed by the rising cost of raw materials and the current U.S.-China trade tensions. Lily Jan with towing supplies company Runva says some of its metal hooks are on the potential list of tariffs by the U.S.
If the tariff is increased by 25%, then American importers have to either increase their prices by 25% or demand a lower price from suppliers like us. There are only two ways. Someone must absorb the extra costs, and we can't afford to.
So it'll be down to us, consumers, to pay more. There is skepticism about whether tariffs will, in fact, bring factory jobs back to the U.S. Again, Amazon seller Brad Schultz.
A lot of the things that are produced here, we just don't even have the knowledge or the intelligence of how to produce those in the United States today.
So for now, he says, he will continue to sell made-in-China items to Americans. In Guangzhou City, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Barn Door Horse Division. The Securities and Exchange Commission has levied a fine against the company formerly known as Yahoo for that gargantuan hack back in 2014, the one that exposed personal data for more than 500 million Yahoo accounts. Verizon, you might remember, bought all the good Yahoo bits a couple of years ago. What's left and the entity that was fined this week has rebranded as Altaba. Anyway, the fine is $35 million. That's $35 million for not disclosing a hack of 500 million accounts. You do the math. That is 7 cents per account. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials climbed 59 points today, about 0.25%. NASDAQ down 3, less than 0.1%. S&P 500 up 4, call that about 0.1% there. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.